More riveting information here up next. Let's talk a little bit about UFOs in wartime. Mac Maloney with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Mac Maloney with us. Mac, let's move on to your past work, UFOs in wartime. And that procedure, how did you go about researching something like that?
Well, it took a lot longer than I thought it was going to take. I was able to get in touch with an author named Keith Chester, who had written a book called Strange Company, which was based on Foo Fighters. It's really the defining book on Foo Fighters. And I had a long discussion with him because we had had this theory, my editor and I, that I had first brought to him, that UFOs seemed to be spotted more during wartime than in peacetime, and we really didn't know why. Was it because, you know, now, especially in the 20th century, we had airplanes flying around, more opportunities to see strange things flying, more people on the ground looking up at airplanes? We didn't quite know. So we said, let's try to do a book about it. I talked to Keith Chester. He kind of set me straight on what happened during World War II, and that more Foo Fighters were seen than anyone ever imagined and seen by all sides. And then we went back into, it turns out that people were seeing strange flying things during World War I, during the 30s, certainly, then all the way into the Cold War. Lots of UFOs spotted over Korea during the Korean War, Vietnam War. So when we came upon all this evidence, it just it seemed like it would make a good book, so we put the book together.
Now, in UFOs in wartime with the Foo Fighters, what do you think they were doing? What were they up to?
It's really hard to say. In the vast majority of cases, it just seems like these UFOs, these Foo Fighters, were there watching what was going on. There is no recorded evidence during World War II of Foo Fighters firing on our airplanes, firing on our troops on the ground. They just seem to be observing, and in some cases, observing very closely. Like, we have stories in that book about British bombers over Essen, a German city, bombing it at night in the middle of this fierce air battle, and there were UFOs riding right off the wings of these Lancaster bombers, just watching. And that led me to this theory. Once again, I'm not the person who came up with this, but it really got me thinking that these things might actually be time travelers. They might be time machines. There might be people from our future coming back simply to see history as it's being made.
They were relatively small craft, weren't they?
Well, a lot of them were orbs and spheres. But that's another interesting thing, is that that's what I always thought they were. They were just kind of balls of light. But if you go, when we went into the research, it turns out that British and American pilots saw all kinds of shapes, the cigar-shaped objects, flying saucer objects, what they called unguided rockets, which were kind of a missile-shaped object. So there was about five or six different shapes of Foo Fighters that were seen during World War II.
So they looked like they did have some physical, material look to them.
Yes, definitely. A lot of people did see these kind of orbs of light, and there was a lot of reports of these orbs of light following airplanes. But we also uncovered, and thanks to Keith Chester's book, uncovered, just your stand-in, if we can use that term, UFO, flying saucer shape, the very famous cigar-shaped objects, lots of different, five or six at least, different shapes of Foo Fighters seen during World War II.
And different sizes?
Different sizes. Some of them were immense. Some of them were small.
If they were small, could they have been, like, robotic? Or do you think the whatever occupants might have been in there might have been, like, an inch or 2 inches tall?
Well, yeah, it's hard to say. You know, I mean, they might have been just a robotic kind of, let's say, a camera, remote viewing device or something along those lines. But the one thing that, was held throughout all of the war, in the Pacific as well as the European theater, people seem to think that Foo Fighters only showed up over Europe, but they're in the Pacific theater as well, is that they were always just there kind of taking in what was going on, and frequently what was going on was some kind of battle.
Did you ever look at what was that object over Los Angeles during the war?
Well, we did a chapter on that. That's a fascinating story because it's probably one of the more people probably saw that UFO than in any other instance. At least a million people were awoken, and it was the middle of February in 1942 when the Navy intelligence warned the people in Los Angeles that there was going to be some kind of an air raid. There's a lot of anti-aircraft batteries in L.A. at the time because there was a lot of defense plants. And sure enough, these lights showed up over Los Angeles at 2 in the morning. People, and there was this fierce battle. The anti-aircraft batteries were shooting at these things for more than 2 hours.
They could hear it ping.
Yeah,
right?
Hear it hitting. Yeah, absolutely. And not only were there at least a million people seeing this happening, but there were reporters. There were 8 newspapers in Los Angeles at the time, and they all had reporters out. A lot of police and a lot of military were on buildings watching these things through binoculars and into the naked eye. And there's a very famous photo, which we have in the book, of a UFO caught in the beams of about 5 or 6 searchlights.
Yeah.
And it looks just like a standing UFO. But what it was, what they were, no one ever found out. The next day, the Navy said nothing happened. The Army said something happened. We just don't know what it is. Then the law censors, just put a clamp on the story the next day, and it more or less went away. But we devote one chapter in UFOs and Wartime to it. But that's really something. If someone wanted to take a really good scientific look at a very prominent UFO sighting, that would be the one that I would pick because just so many people saw it.
I think so, too. You know, and the original fear, Mac, was because, it was the war. They thought people, they thought it might have been the Japanese. They were panicking, weren't they?
Yeah, there was definite panic involved because, first of all, they did warn the people in L.A., or the authorities in L.A., that there might be an air raid that night. The day before, a Japanese submarine had surfaced off a town about 100 miles north of Los Angeles and shelled an oil refinery there. So they knew the Japanese were in the area. But after the war, they asked the Japanese, were you responsible for this? And the Japanese said no, because, number one, the Japanese didn't have, aircraft carriers that could go all the way from Japan to the coast of California and launch an attack and then disappear without anyone seeing them. There were rumors that they were taking off from Mexico and stuff, but the Japanese said, we had nothing to do with this. So something was over Los Angeles that night. We never found out what it was.
It was dramatic. And, it was caught by the lights, and then it just slowly moved away, didn't it?
And so much anti-aircraft fire was shot at these things that the falling shrapnel killed 6 people on the ground and did a lot of property damage. It's just very unusual. I mean, can you imagine if something like that happened today? What it would be like. But just the fact that it happened during the war, especially early in the war censors just came in, put a clamp on the story, and that was it.
And apparently a lot of witnesses say the photo looked like it was 100 feet in width, 8,000 feet high. Yeah, it was over Culver City. It was a strange, strange story.
Right. I agree. It really was. Very interesting story.
Mac, where do you think all this is headed? What do you think has been going on?
Well, Roger, I wish I knew. There's just so much evidence and just so many sightings of UFOs around the world every day. There's some figure that said that 1,000 UFOs reported around the world every month after month. And those are just the ones that people report. People seem to want to believe that UFOs hide from us, but they don't hide from us. They're around all the time. They obviously exist. We just don't know what they are yet. I'm really leaning towards this idea that these things are time travelers. A lot of things that they do kind of lend themselves to that, where they're always just observing us. They're always kind of looking in on us. They don't really there's very few stories of them taking any kind of action. Of course, there is the whole abduction phenomenon, but just looking at it from, as we have with this kind of military point of view, there's very few instances where UFOs have fired on our airplanes or anything like that. They always just seem to be there watching us. And I don't know, it might be something just as simple as time travelers, time tourists, coming back and seeing history as it's being made.
Well, I was going to say, could they be us from the future?
There's a good chance that they are, because there's an actual small part of biology that says that the more a species evolved, the more they become to look like their fetus state. And, when you look at gray aliens, they do kind of have a fetus shape to them. And I just think that time travel makes just a little bit more sense than ETs. Of course, it could be both. It could be both. I think a lot of things are going on in this world that we might not have. Our consciousness just can't understand what they're going, what is going on. Maybe we will reach a point, maybe someday, you know, that theoretical UFO will land on the White House lawn, and we'll finally know. But I think what's probably going to happen is Jerry Clark, who's a very famous UFO writer, he predicts that in about 50 years, the scientific community will get over the stigma of looking into UFOs, and they will do a really good scientific investigation on what UFOs might be, and maybe they will get to the bottom of it. But if they don't reveal themselves to us, it's going to take scientists looking into what UFOs are. And certainly it's not going to be the military who's going to tell us anything.
Mac, I've got the original CBS report of that Los Angeles situation from 1942. I want you to listen to it with me, okay? Here we go.
The News of the World, Wednesday, February 25th. Once again, Columbia's correspondents in world capitals and in the fighting zones in the Western Pacific are ready to give you the latest news direct by shortwave radio. And now for news of our own West Coast, we take you to Los Angeles and the report of Byron Palmer. Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning. The anti-aircraft guns began barking during a blackout ordered by the 4th Interceptor Command at 2:25 a.m. The unidentified object, which some sources thought might be a blimp, moved slowly down the Pacific coast from Santa Monica and disappeared south of Long Beach. Army officials declined to comment on the possibility that the object might have been a blimp. However, it required nearly 30 minutes to travel some 25 miles. Far slower than an airplane. Watchers on the rooftop of the Columbia Broadcasting Building in the heart of Hollywood could plainly see the flashes of guns and searchlights sweeping the skies in a wide arc along the coastal area. Concussion of the shells could be felt in downtown Los Angeles, 15 miles away. U.S. Army planes quickly took to the dark skies, but whether they contacted the object has not been announced. Army officials say they will not comment until they receive a full report of the action. Although some watchers say they saw airplanes in the air, semi-official sources say they probably were the U.S. Army's pursuit. Several observers say they saw one or more planes spotlighted by 20 or 30 searchlights. The object moved southward, presumably over Huntington Park at the western edge of Los Angeles, and on southward to about Long Beach on the coast. By 3:30 a.m., observers said the object appeared to be over the south of Long Beach. Searchlights closely followed the object down the coast and kept it centered in their glare. Shells frequently could be seen bursting near the object, but none appeared to hit it. The shooting stopped about 3:30 a.m. The shooting brought warfare to the front door of this city of 1.25 million population for the first time since December 7th. Already, it was alert to the presence off the Southern California coast of a Japanese submarine, which had pumped 25 shells into an oil field north of Santa Barbara Monday evening. Because of the presence of the submarine, a three-hour alert was ordered at dusk last night, and civilian authorities stood at their posts while the Army and Navy continued their search for the submersible. The evening alert ended at 10:23 p.m., but another was sounded at 2:22 a.m., and the blackout followed within 3 minutes. It covered Los Angeles County from Santa Monica to Pomona. At 2:27, all Southern California radio stations were ordered off the air, except those in San Diego. Approximately 20 minutes after the firing died down, the ship returned and headed westward from Long Beach toward Santa Monica. The guns went into action again, hurling round after round of shells at the object. The second barrage appeared to be closer to downtown Los Angeles, since watchers could hear the concussion of the guns more clearly and the flash of bursting shells was brighter. Then the ship disappeared for the second time over the ocean. We return you now to CBS in New York.
Here I am in Los Angeles. Lex, by the way, has a picture of that photo of the light barrage on our Twitter feed. Mac, isn't that incredible?
That's just incredible. And, you know, if you factor out the, you know, that we were at war at the time and that people were assuming that this was some kind of something that was Japanese in origin, if you just take all that away, that's just a classic UFO sighting.
It sure is. And it just didn't leave. It went away. It came back. went all over the place, went up and down the coast.
Right.
I mean, that truly a strange, strange story. If it were a blimp, they would have blown it out of the sky.
Sure. The first shot that would hit the blimp would have just taken it down, and everyone would have known it was a blimp. In fact, we got research saying that there were these barrage balloons that they used to have that they would put over these kind of targets, but none of them were up that night. And they were tethered, too. Barrage balloons are tethered. So what this thing was, I mean, I think that's just a great report on a typical UFO sighting that just happened to happen during war.
Truly amazing. And I love those old announcers, Mac, because they truly painted pictures with words, didn't
they? That's for sure. That, especially that guy. He did a really good job.
Yep, he sure did. So, and then was there ever any follow-up to that story? I mean, was there an investigation or anything?
Nothing that was made public. There was a report that the Secretary of War at the time made a report to FDR about it, but I don't think anyone could figure out exactly what happened. I mean, the one theory that I mentioned before is that these were Japanese airplanes that were disguised as airliners taking off from Mexico. I mean, it was just, you know, almost like a pulp paperback plot or something. You know, it just didn't make any sense. And then we know later on the Japanese said that it wasn't us. But at the time, and that's why it's interesting that it happened during wartime, that the war censors were able to come in and just put a clamp on the story. And then it just really went away. Steven Spielberg made a movie called 1941.
I remember that, with Aykroyd and Belushi, right?
And that was more like Animal House in the Air, you know, it was like a comedy. But it was based on that event. And then the Battle of L.A. was a movie that came out about a year ago and had some kind of connection to it. But once again, I think if some scientific research group really wanted to look at a UFO sighting that had a lot of witnesses, a lot of evidence, that's the one to look at.
I think so, too. It's just an amazing story. But there are many like that that are out there that you've looked at, you've investigated. Something very strange is going on. And Mac, it's still strange. It's still happening.
Right. We don't know any more than we did when Kenneth Arnold saw the first, quote-unquote, flying saucers.
In 47. No, you're 47. Right.
It's just that people see them all the time. They're here. I mean, I think we see them more these days than not. There's more evidence. But just what it is, it really is a puzzle. And, again, I just wish that some scientific research community would just look into it and forget the stigma about looking into UFOs and just really take a good, long, hard look at UFOs and try to figure out what they are. And once again, it's the U.S. military, it shouldn't be their job to do it. It should be a scientific investigation.
Indeed. Mac, people who want to get your works, where do they go? How do they find it?
Well, the books are they're published by Penguin Publishing, so they're at every bookstore across the country, or they can go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. Amazon.com is probably the best place to get them, or they can go to MacMaloney.com for information on all the books that we've done.
And we've got that all linked up for everybody at CoastToCoastAM.com as well. What are you working on next, Mac?
Well, that's a good question. I have another book out called Attack on Area 51, which is a fictional story about this series character I've been doing for years called Wingman. Hawk Hunter is the wingman, and he's a fighter pilot. He has to find a secret to his past, and it happens to be at Area 51. I had all this Area 51 research lying around my office, and a publisher said, why don't you do a fictional book on Area 51? So I did at the same time as doing Beyond Area 51. So I was able to research two books at the same time, and that's a $2 download from Amazon.com. A lot of people really like that book.
All right, we're going to come back and take some phone calls with you, Mac. Mac Maloney with us, Beyond Area 51 and UFOs in Wartime. That's all next with you on Coast to Coast AM. Mac Maloney with us. We're going to take your calls and continue chatting about his work, Beyond Area 51, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Mac Maloney with us, and your phone calls as well. Mac, great job, by the way, in all your research. Now, in your book, Beyond Area 51, any favorite story there?
Well, I think the most interesting place that we look into is this place called the M Triangle in Russia. It's in the it's near the Ural Mountains in Russia. It's in a very isolated area. It's about 40 square miles of heavily wooded area, but there are some kind of plains, valleys, and rivers running through it. It was always kind of known as a haunted forest to the people who lived there for the past few hundred years. During the Soviet government, the KGB wouldn't let anyone into this place, so they knew something was going on in there. And then when the Soviet Union fell and the Russian government, a little more liberal than the Soviets, came into power, they started letting journalists and researchers into this place. And it's just a very strange place. It's a lot like the St. Louis Valley in a way, where people see UFOs almost all the time, but even stranger things happen there. People have seen, like, strange writing in the sky. They've reported the stars making these kind of interesting formations. They report that, like, the animals have no fear of humans there. There's always a kind of musical sound that is going through this place. If you light a match there, it blows up almost like it's being fueled by gasoline. You can't not make any cell phone calls from the M-Triangle except in this one place that they call the call box. It's just a five-foot square. If you stand in the middle of it, you can make a cell phone call to anywhere in the world. But what's even stranger is when people go in there and then they come out, the Russians call, they seem like they have a new soul. People have gone in there with really devastating diseases and come out cured. People go in there, and after 2 or 3 weeks there, they come out, and they are actually smarter. We do a story about this gentleman. He has a very Russian name. I'm not going to try to pronounce it. But he was a unemployed ex-Soviet soldier, got washed out of the military for medical reasons, became a journalist, and got assigned to do a story on the M-Triangle. People magazine just happened to be there while he was there. He was there for 2.5 weeks, saw a number of amazing things, went back to Moscow, wrote his story. But after he left, he suddenly was infused with this knowledge of astrophysics and physics and astronomy and engineering. He had no idea where all this knowledge was coming from, but so much of it came to him that within a year and a half, he was a cosmonaut with no formal training at all. It's a very, very strange place. People call it a little piece of heaven, very kind of peaceful place. People just, when they leave, they're not the same type of person. So, once again, we do a chapter on it. I think an entire book could be done about this place. If I had my choice to go to any place that we mentioned in the book, I would go to the M-Triangle.
Okay, let's go to get some of the calls here for you now. We'll go to Rockford, North Carolina. Greg's with us on the wild card line. Hi, Greg.
Hey, George. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Greg.
You guys had wondered how they lowered a plane underground at Area 51.
Right.
David Adair was on the program a couple years ago. He was a rocket scientist. And they shot one of his rockets into Area 51, and then after they got him in there, they took him into a hangar that he said you could put 4 or 5 747s in this hangar and still have lots of room to move around. And he said they lowered it with a screw that operated like a lipstick. And it lowered it way down into the ground. He said the floor just started to drop out, and this entire hangar just dropped underground. So I don't know how much credibility you put into David Adair, but
I like David. David's been a good guest on the program, and yet that is indeed what he did say then. That's true.
Yeah. Also, I watched Conspiracy Files the other night, and they had a guy on that said he worked for the government at the underground base in Dulce, and they had a battle down there between the guards and the aliens, and he had 3 of his fingers shot off, and he showed his hand with 3 fingers missing. His little finger, his ring finger, and his middle finger had been shot off. And he said this was done during a battle underground at the underground base in Dulce. So I don't know.
Do you remember that, Mac? I think if there was a battle with ETs, we probably would lose.
Right. You know, that story has been floating around, and I'm not sure how this gentleman lost his 3 fingers. But, you know, once again, these stories about Dulce came from a disinformation campaign that came out of the Air Force security people at Kirtland Air Force Base and has just kind of taken on a life of its own over the years. I just don't think anything is there. I think it's just one of these stories that has made the rounds and just keeps getting elaborated on. But to his first point about having a hangar where you could actually put planes in and they are lowered into the ground, you know, on our aircraft carriers, that's exactly what they do on a smaller basis.
That's right. Oh,
you know, the hangar for an aircraft carrier is in the middle of the ship, and they put two or three airplanes on this elevator
and
that is
send them up
to the flight deck. So if you can imagine something that on a grander scale, you know, at Area 51, you know, I don't think that's too outside the realm of possibility.
How long do you think it took to build that area?
Well, it's built up over the years. Actually, my brother, who was in the Air Force for 25 years, he was out there twice in the early 70s, not to do anything, you know, black ops, but just to fix some airplanes that had broken down there. He was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base at the time. And then it was only a handful of hangars. But it has definitely been built up over the years. And I know there's all kinds of stories that sometimes they say the military, you know, is planning to move out or they have moved out. But it's still operations are still going on there. I think they're adding on to it all the time. I wouldn't be surprised if there are some underground facilities there because, you know, with nuclear war, maybe not as much of a danger as it was during the Cold War, but there's always a danger that something like that is going to happen. Underground is the place where you want to be. So the interesting thing is, will we ever know? You know, will it be shut down and turned into a museum maybe in 50 or 100 years? I don't know. But if it is, I think we'll be really surprised at actually what they have going on out there.
Next up, let's go to Diego in Colorado on the wild card line. Hi, Diego. Go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen. I was wondering, what do you think about the idea of aliens? You know, like, let me see how I can explain this. A lot of people get sightings, right? You know, whether it's someone who is a U.S. Air Force pilot, they see a lot of sightings of UFOs, much like how celebrities tend to have a lot of encounters with the paranormal and ghosts and demons. Do you think celebrities can be targeted as well by aliens to be shown themselves to, or do you think they specifically choose people in the government to show themselves to?
Well, we did I did a story for TrueTV.com about celebrities who have seen UFOs, and Ronald Reagan actually saw two UFOs. He was going on his way to a party in the early 50s, and he and Nancy Reagan were driving down the Pacific Coast Highway, saw a bunch of people had pulled over, and they were watching a UFO that was flying out over the Pacific Ocean. And when he went to this celebrity party, a lot of other celebrities are there, and he just kind of, you know, had them in the palm of his hand telling him about this UFO he spotted. Plus, when he was governor of California, he was in his campaign plane, and a UFO came right up beside the plane. In fact, he told the pilot to pursue it. I know those celebrity ghost stories. Someone in the business told me that, and, you know, I don't want to tell tales out of school, but apparently a lot of those, they just approach the people and offer them $10,000 and give them a script. Because it just seems like an odd, you know, an unusually large number of celebrities see ghosts. I'm not sure about that. But getting to your larger questions, is it possible that UFOs show themselves to people of prominence, military people, celebrities? It's an interesting theory. I wish I had the answer, but I don't.
Next up, Terrell is with us in Danielsville, Georgia. That's east of the Rockies, of course. Hi, Terrell.
Good evening, George. How are you tonight?
Good, sir. Thank you.
First of all, I just love this program. It keeps me alive.
Good.
I would like to say, if you and your guests, if we could view a cross-section of the North American continent sliced, it would look like Swiss cheese for the first several miles from the crust of the earth downward. There are so many caverns, tunnels, and built-up places that were here a long time before we showed up. We've added to them. Our military stumbled onto some of these. Aliens have lived within our planet's confines for eons. You have to be underground to hide from other aliens because there's been ancient wars in the past. So these things are written in the text in India, and you know, always it's all over the programs I've watched on TV and everything. And it's just too much to even begin to mention. But first of all, we as a species, we have to get our act together until we become a peaceful, coexistent group of individuals, raise our consciousness and spiritual level up. We're never going to have much interaction with the aliens.
Well, Terrell, you're absolutely correct. I mean, and we are all a long way from being accepted into the Federation, Mac, don't you think?
Well, yes, I agree with them 100% that, you know, we as a people, I mean, the United States and just civilizations around the world, for some reason, even though we've evolved, we cannot get rid of this gene that makes us want to go to war. Just think of all the money that is spent on military weapons and so on, spent over the year, trillions and trillions of dollars. And if that money was put into scientific research, we'd be off this planet years ago. I mean, decades ago. I'm just a big believer in science, looking into our problems, science fixing our problems. And, you know, I know very few problems are fixed by politicians. But the sad thing is that, you know, the politicians are running things these days. And just the way that the world is, where everyone is just armed to the teeth. And when you have a lot of weapons around, this is all throughout history, when you have a lot of weapons around, wars are inevitable. They're just going to happen. I just wish we could change our mindset on that. But I really don't see that anytime soon, sad to say.
Mac, do you think the Germans possessed UFO technology?
No, I don't. And that's another story that's, you know, theory that's been around for a long time. But, you know, once again, you just look at the numbers. The Germans did have a lot of advanced weapons during World War II, no doubt about it. The V-1, V-2 rockets. They had the first jet fighter, the ME-262. But when the ME-262 really came into service, which was in the latter part of 1943, the Germans lacked so many of the basic necessities to build anything that the cockpit of the ME-262, the world's first jet fighter, was made out of plywood because they couldn't afford to make it out of steel or anything that was a little more protective of the pilot. When we went into, after the war, when Allied forces went into Germany, they found no evidence at all of any kind of UFO-type factories, any kind of infrastructure that the Germans might have had that could build anti-gravitational devices and things that you hear these stories about these days. They just didn't have the resources. They didn't have the manpower. For the last 2 years of the war, I mean, they could barely feed their troops, never mind their people. And once again, there was no infrastructure ever found after the war that would lead anyone to believe that they had all these fantastic weapons that some people claim they had.
Remember the Nazi bell?
Yeah, we do a story, we do a chapter in the book about the Nazi bell. And once again, it's the same thing, where I know a lot of people have written about that, lectured about it, and so on and so forth. But when you really look into what was going on there, nothing was going on there. It came from a story that one person said that he came upon these papers. He never had copies of the papers. He was only allowed to read them and make notes that there was some kind of an anti-gravitational device being made at that place in Poland, which was under Nazi occupation. And that has led to stories that the Nazis had anti-gravitational devices, that they had a base down in Antarctica, that they were on the moon in 1942. It sounds great. It's really cool science fiction, I guess, except that, you know, it involves the Nazis. But once again, to build the atom bomb in the United States took 5 years. It took $25 billion. It took something like 200,000 people to work on the atom bomb. Well, the Germans would have had to have some kind of an infrastructure, some kind of a support system along those same lines to have an anti-gravitational device to go to the moon in 1942. And there's just no evidence that they had any kind of resources like that. So, once again, cool science fiction. I don't like the fact that people want to assign more intelligence to the Nazis than they had. They were just a vile bunch of people, and that's how we should remember them in history. Certainly not that they had all these super weapons. And then, of course, why did they lose the war if they had all this cool stuff?
Exactly. We've got Larry in Fort Wayne, Indiana now. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Sure, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Great show tonight.
Thank
and this
you, Larry.
Goes back to the L.A. incident. Great broadcast, by the way. I'd never heard that before.
Wasn't that so? It was riveting.
Oh, it was great. I'd like to find a copy of it. But I believe I'd heard on Coast to Coast before another gentleman talk about this incident, and I believe I'd seen it on a program or read in another book about that incident. And I believe on the program of Coast, I heard a speaker talk about that during the bombing or the shootout of the flak, that a craft was shot down and that General Stilwell, who was in charge of the security of the L.A. and the West Coast, immediately contacted Roosevelt and said, this is not of this world what we shot down. Now, I don't know if there's any I was thinking there was documents or communique or anything like that, but I was wondering if the speaker had any comment about that, because I know earlier in the broadcast they mentioned that there wasn't much follow-up after that.
Okay, we'll do it.
Off the air.
You got it. I have not heard anything that we shot something down.
No, I've never heard anything that we shot anything down. A lot of the shrapnel from anti-aircraft fire came down, and as I said, killed six people, did a lot of damage on the ground. But we really looked into this, and there is a lot of documentation about the Battle of L.A. out there, but I've never heard anything about anything being shot down. If it was shot down, I think a lot of people would have seen it. But what you hear mostly is that the anti-aircraft batteries were shooting at something. They heard noises of the shells pinging off of whatever these objects were or the object was, but I've never heard of anything actually being shot down.
And something was pinging. People did hear that.
Yeah, people did actually think they saw, you know, the anti-aircraft shells exploding on this thing, and to no effect, which certainly it means it certainly wasn't a blimp. And you know, you just look at and it's just so much documentation. So many eyewitnesses saw these things. You have to just think to yourself, what was this thing? It was impervious to our anti-aircraft batteries, flying over L.A. for almost 2 hours being shot at.
I would have loved to have been there. Can you believe it was 71 years ago?
It's amazing.
I wonder if there's got to be some survivors left who witnessed that. What do you think?
Oh, I'm sure there are. In fact, there was
80, 90 years old, though.
Right. There was one gentleman who I think we got an email from. He said that his father, what he used to do, his father was a car mechanic, and the shrapnel that had fallen to the ground was actually used for currency out there in the days and weeks afterwards, where people would get their cars fixed if they could give him a piece of the shrapnel that fell to the ground.
Didn't know that.
I'm sure there's a lot of people there. There's got to be a number of people there who still remember it.
We're going to come back, Mac. Final hour to go of phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch your dial.